This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Martin Luther King's true legacy has been lost to cultural amnesia, according to my guest, Michael Eric Dyson. In his new book, I May Not Get There With You, Dyson argues that King's strengths have been needlessly exaggerated, and so have his weaknesses. Dyson considers King the greatest American who ever lived, but Dyson says what makes King great is his sublime mix of the profound and the profane. Dyson's goal is to rescue King from his admirers and deliver him from his foes. Dyson's other books include Making Malcolm, The Myth and Meaning of Malcolm X, and Between God and Gangster Rap. Dyson is an ordained Baptist minister and a professor at DePaul University. How many years have you been teaching college?
I've been teaching college for over a decade.
Have you found that your students' attitudes toward King have changed at all in those years, you know, as you see different classes of students?
As I get older and they get younger.
Right. There you go.
The inevitable progress of time there. I think that many of the students simply don't know much about Martin Luther King Jr., so they tend to view him as this icon, this saint, this hero, who was amazingly distant from ourselves. My very good friend Susan Thistlethwaite, who was the president of Chicago Theological Seminary, says that her son spent an afternoon, for instance, with Jesse Jackson. And when coming home, she said, "You know, Mom, Reverend Jackson talks like Martin Luther King Jr. was a real man." And I think that many young people don't understand that this was a flesh and blood man, that he had wants and needs and desires, that he had failures and faults, but that he had an amazing amount of courage and integrity and beauty and genius that resides in all of us. And I think the beauty of Martin Luther King Jr.'s memory, for those of us who are trying to seize it back from the radical right and for those who have tried to lionize Martin Luther King Jr. while disrespecting the very people from whom he emerged, I think the beauty of that is that he is a human being full of wonder and glory and genius, but also the normal and ordinary human afflictions that all of us endure. And for that reason, we're able to overcome some of the failures and faults that we have to make a real and significant achievement, a real contribution to American society. So I think that's the Martin Luther King Jr. that young people need to see, need to hear about, need to discuss.
You know, you describe Martin Luther King as being portrayed now as a saint instead of a man who was filled with contradictions, a man who had to struggle with some of his own impulses. How do you think that saint image was created?
Well, it was created for a variety of reasons. First of all, it was created because a white America needed this black hero to justify attacks on the black power movement and upon those black people who wanted to celebrate violence. So Martin Luther King Jr. was a convenient hero. We must remember that in 1967, for the first time in a decade, King had fallen off of the Gallup poll's 10 most admired American list. So he was not being celebrated by white America or profoundly embraced by black people. Universities were rejecting him for lectureships. New York publishers said they were not interested in the book by him. So he was at the low point of his career when he was murdered. The powerful waves of martyrdom swept back the ocean of opposition to King to now put him at the top of the heap of American heroes to join the great pantheon of figures like Lincoln and Jefferson and so on. So white America needed a great hero. Black America equally needed a hero to celebrate the ingenuity of black achievement, to suggest that this figure was powerful and insightful precisely because he took the American dilemma by the horns and tried to shake it loose. All those things came together and served neatly to make Martin Luther King Jr. the acclaimed figure he is today.
You know, a lot of people are just really confused and appalled at the revelations of Martin Luther King's extramarital affairs. You kind of see that as an opportunity to discuss that he wasn't a saint, he was a man, and that we should embrace him with his imperfections and help use that to understand other people's imperfections as well. How do you bring this up with your students when you're discussing Martin Luther King and talking about his imperfections as well as his leadership?
Yes. What I do in discussing this issue with my students is, first of all, make certain that they understand that I know and believe that Martin Luther King Jr. was the greatest American we've ever produced in American society. When he was murdered in Memphis, his blood stained the American conscience like few other events have done. So I suggest that Martin Luther King Jr. was a man worthy of valorization, worthy of becoming a hero, and indeed, as the Catholic Church has suggested, worthy of being named a martyr of the 21st century. On the other hand, I suggest that we have to tackle those thorny issues of morality that Martin Luther King Jr. struggled with. And I bring it up to my students in the context of saying, listen, this was a flesh and blood human being who had limitations. And if we expect more out of King than we expect of ourselves, we're really doing a grave disservice to Martin Luther King Jr. Because he was able to overcome the odds against that were stacked against him, you too as young people can overcome the odds that were stacked against you. But it would be a disservice to us to pretend that Martin Luther King Jr. had to be morally perfect in order to achieve something. It would be unfair to him precisely because no human being can match that kind of record. No human being can really live up to the ideals that he or she embodies, even in his own preaching or her own life. So I suggested to them that Martin Luther King Jr., as a flesh and blood human being, struggled not only against white supremacy and economic inequality, but struggled with himself. There were at least two or three Martin Luther King Jr.'s competing for supremacy in his own life. On the one hand, there was the very introverted Martin Luther King Jr., who was quite shy. If you read the essays of James Baldwin, he talks about meeting King, who was never impressed with himself, who was never puffed up with a bunch of hubris or pride. Then there was the Martin Luther King Jr., who was the world historical figure, in the words of Hegel, who felt that he had to really bear the burden of African-American people in the face of the onslaught of white supremacy. And then there was the King, who was just a human being saying, look, I don't even deserve half the press that I get. I don't deserve being featured as the preeminent leader of American morality and certainly Black America. And I simply want to go back and teach in school somewhere, become a dean somewhere. I want to shrink back from the necessity of always being representative of the race and of ultimately God. But in the face of all of that, Martin Luther King Jr. struggled with his own depression, especially for the last 4 years of his life, overcoming that depression, living with that depression to still make great speeches, to still lead people in the quest for freedom, and to still every day imagine a future radically different than the one that he had to endure.
As you point out in your book, when Ralph Abernathy wrote in his book that the night before Martin Luther King was assassinated, he spent time with two or three women who were not his wife. A lot of people felt that Abernathy was a traitor to make that information public and tarnish King's image. What do you think about that?
Well, I think two things. First of all, Ralph Abernathy had an obligation as a scribe, as a writer, as an intellectual, to tell the truth as best he could and as he knew it. So in one sense, I think the drudging up of old stories and the drubbing of Ralph Abernathy was misled. On the other hand, I think that we have to acknowledge that Ralph Abernathy was jealous of Martin Luther King Jr. from the very beginning. When King won the Nobel Prize, Ralph Abernathy said, I deserve half that money. He wanted to travel in the same kind of stature and regard and glory that King enjoyed. So there was not a love-hate relationship, but a love-jealous relationship with King his entire life. And I think that reflects itself in Ralph Abernathy's book. Finally, I think Ralph Abernathy was hypocritical because he didn't acknowledge that he was joined in some of his affairs by Martin Luther King Jr. early in their careers. So Ralph Abernathy himself sinned quite greatly, but did not acknowledge that in his own book.
Do you think that Martin Luther King's views changed as he got deeper into the civil rights movement and as he took the civil rights movement north and started to understand how northern racism compared to southern racism?
Yes, without question. When Martin Luther King Jr. moved northward after the great movements ending in the South in 65, going to Chicago in 66 and then to Cleveland in 67, I think he saw a much different beast. On the one hand, he saw how lethal and subtle white supremacy was up north. There was no need of white water fountains and signs about blacks don't enter here because the North was deeply segregated in its own right, especially in Chicago, which is a profoundly diverse but deeply segregated city. So Martin Luther King Jr. began to see that racial commerce flowed underground, that they didn't have to beat people up explicitly. They just beat them down psychologically. And moreover, I think the ingenuity of Richard Daley, the mayor then, was that he had a lot of black patronage. He had a lot of black people in his pocket, politicians and preachers as well. So that Martin Luther King Jr. was not simply fighting the forces of white supremacy, he was fighting the fact that many black people had been co-opted by and capitulated to the political machinery of Richard Daley. And he also understood that black people had a deeper psychological debt to white people up north than they had claimed to have. One of the untold stories is that Martin Luther King Jr. was so disgusted with some of the actions of black people up north because, as his aide Hosea Williams said, we're used to dealing with people who want to be free. Blacks in Chicago are so psychologically beat down and domesticated and really having the sort of plantation mentality that you would expect from the South that we can't even get a foothold in here because they are so beholden to the powers that be. And Martin Luther King Jr. faced the lethal intensity of this patronage to a political machinery that he had not learned to master. And that was a real revelation to him. And so he also saw, however, the sort of hostility and the sort of animus that he said he had never seen in the South. When King came here to Chicago and was hit in the head with a rock, he stopped during that march, and one of the most memorable statements he made, he said, "I've never seen such hostility and hatred in the eyes of men and women anywhere in America as I have seen here in Chicago." And that was quite a revelation to him, and it made him know that he had to change his strategy. No longer could he appeal to the conscience of a country that intended to do the right thing but that had stumbled along the way. Now he had to blaze a different path. Now he had to talk about forcing America to do the right thing. Now he had to talk about what he termed aggressive nonviolence to force American society to make the substantive racial transformation it needed to have in order to reach real justice.
You suggest in your book that it might turn out that Martin Luther King, even more than Malcolm X, is the father of the hip-hop generation. What do you mean?
Well, I mean several things. First of all, because they had in common some habits, smoking, drinking, certainly their habits of sexuality. And in King's case, as with some other hip-hoppers' case, certain issues of promiscuity, charges of having children out of wedlock, and so on and so forth. All of these things join Martin Luther King Jr. to the hip-hop generation to a certain degree on the surface. But even more in depth, I have three things in mind. First of all, that Martin Luther King Jr., like hip-hoppers, used old ancient texts, words, and sources in a fresh new way. He brought them out of the dustbin, so to speak, and gave them a fresh hearing by using them in his own sermons. Martin Luther King Jr. borrowed the sermons of white liberal ministers and the words of colleagues in the civil rights movement who had none of the fame that King enjoyed, but he gave their words a broader audience, a global audience indeed, and put them in the larger trajectory of the moral ambitions of the civil rights movement. So I think in that sense, like an excellent producer within hip-hop, King was able to sample the words of others and give them fresh meaning. Secondly, his viewpoints about women were distressingly similar to the viewpoints of hip-hoppers. As with hip-hop today, there's some very problematic beliefs about women that are circulating, and King certainly had his view of women that was quite chauvinistic and indeed, in some levels, quite sexist. Thirdly, I think, however, they both struggled with the issue of social suffering and evil. They dealt with economic inequality, and they dealt with racial oppression. And finally, many of the hip-hoppers, Tupac Shakur and Biggie Smalls, to name just two, were obsessed with their deaths in the same way that Martin Luther King Jr. was obsessed with his own death. Of course, King was being threatened every day of his life, and some could argue that Tupac and Biggie brought their deaths upon their own heads by the violent lifestyles they lived. To a certain degree, that's absolutely right, and there is a moral distinction between King and, say, between Biggie and Tupac. But what I am suggesting is that both of them, that is, King and hip-hoppers, were unified in their understanding that their lives were short, or would be perhaps short, that the potential that they had would probably not be realized in their own lifetime, and that they would have to do so much in such a short time. And that similar perception on their parts, I think, links them in a very profound way.
My guest is Michael Eric Dyson, author of the new book, I May Not Get There With You, The True Martin Luther King Jr. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Eric Dyson, author of the new book, I May Not Get There With You, The True Martin Luther King Jr. I'm interested in the impact that Martin Luther King had on you as a young man. Let's start, actually, when you were very young. How old were you when Martin Luther King was assassinated?
I was 9 years old when Dr. King was murdered in Memphis.
What are your memories of that day?
Well, I vividly remember sitting before the television in my home in the inner city in Detroit, Michigan, watching some program, a Western, I believe it was, with my father. And then the news bulletin rudely interrupted the program to announce that Martin Luther King Jr. had been shot in Memphis, Tennessee. And my father just uttered this, that was a veritable, you know, symbol of the rage and the wordless rage and the unspeakable rage and hurt that black America would endure when they found out that King had indeed been murdered. So the newsman interrupted the program and said King had been shot. And I asked my mother, who had joined us by then in the television room there, in the living room, you know, which one is he? And she pointed him out, and then they showed his speech, I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. And I was immediately converted beyond will to this man's perspective, and I began to learn everything I could about him. The newsman eventually broke faith with the program again about a half an hour later and said that Martin Luther King Jr. had died in Memphis, Tennessee. And it was a sad day in my house. It was a sad day in Black America, and it was a sad day in many quarters of America, though the FBI and other figures within our government celebrated and partied when they found that King was murdered. But that deeply influenced me. It was really the birth of my consciousness around the issue of race. Even though I had endured the riots of Detroit the summer before in 1967, nothing affected me like Martin Luther King Jr.'s death that propelled me into the vortex of race in American society and shaped my own understanding of my own career.
As an 8-year-old boy, observing the riots in Detroit, what was your understanding of the riots?
Well, I saw brothers and sisters going down the street with those big afros and having money stuffed under those afros, and men and women going down the street with televisions. And I was going, well, geez, do you think we could get a television? Because we have a terrible television. And I asked my mother, what was this smoke in the sky? And I understood that there was a tremendous tension between Black and white people. I didn't comprehend it in its full complexity, of course. But I was told that there was a disappointment and rage in many of my Black brothers and sisters in the poorest parts of our city. And that, and I certainly was one of those poor people, but we didn't, you know, go out in the streets and riot. We observed the curfew and so on. But my mother and father told me that Black people had been upset because of the unequal treatment and something going wrong in America. And that was my initial introduction into the schism of race in America.
When you started really learning more about Martin Luther King after he was assassinated, what were some of the excerpts of his speeches that really spoke to you, the words that stuck with you most?
Wow. Well, many of them. I never will forget his speech actually in Chicago, where he said, I have no martyr complex. I want to live as long as anybody. If you want us to end our moves into communities, open these communities. Don't put a moratorium on demonstrations. Put a moratorium on injustice. And I shall never forget the first words I heard King speak. That some of us are saying, some people are saying, what will happen to me as a result of our white brothers? Well, I really don't know what will happen now, but it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. I tell you, when I hear those words now, they send goose pimples up my body and make me stop and remark upon the incredible genius that King embodied in that last speech, and that to know that it was an improvised speech, that he didn't initially want to go to the hall that night to deliver that speech, but he was pressed by Ralph Abernathy to come. And in an extraordinary display of rhetorical genius, laid out his vision for the next century. And I think that that speech is the greatest speech of King's career because its prophetic apocalyptic tones are joined with his belief that despite what will happen, that God will see Black people and all well-meaning Americans through to the promised land.
One of the things that you're concerned about now in discussing Martin Luther King's legacy is how his family is handling his papers,
yes.
His home. What are some of your concerns about how the King family is handling the King legacy?
Yes, well, let me clarify, first of all, that the King family, certainly for most of their existence after their father and husband's death, certainly have not enjoyed a high style of living in our country. Mrs. King never moved from the home, the modest home, in a marginal community in which they lived in Atlanta, Georgia. They didn't reap excessive economic benefit from the King legacy until quite recently when they signed the deal with Time Warner, and now the potential $20 million payoff of giving their papers to the Library of Congress, the papers of Martin Luther King Jr. So first of all, I think it's clear to say that they have certainly not economically benefited from that legacy. But they have in recent years tended to exploit the commercial side of the King estate as opposed to the intellectual legacy of Dr. King's commitment to nonviolence. And I think that is a legitimate area where we can scrutinize and subsequently criticize the King family. And I think they want to have it both ways. They want to be both the legatees of Martin Luther King Jr.'s moral legacy while exploiting the intellectual property rights that have accrued to them. I think that they certainly deserve to get paid, as it were, off of King's legacy and certainly deserve to make a comfortable living from their father's and husband's extraordinary commitment. On the other hand, I think that the King family has to acknowledge that they cannot, as the biological heirs of King, control how the world views this great figure. They can put their bid forward, but they must not have a kind of decisive sway over the interpretation of King, because families, as most other families would do, the family of King, I think, has a vested interest in denying the faults and failures of Martin Luther King Jr. for obvious reason, while celebrating a kind of sanitized version of Martin Luther King Jr. on the other hand. And I think we need to see him warts and all precisely because exposing those warts will expose his genius. Finally, I think when the King family decided to sue Henry Hampton, a black man whose company produced the Eyes on the Prize award-winning videos, because he used certain segments of King's speeches and images of him, I think this is something that was quite ridiculous, and I think it contradicted everything King stood for. Here was a man who, as biographer David Garrow said, was impressively as uncommercial as any human being has ever been, and yet the King family has explicitly exploited the commercial side of King's legacy while neglecting, while cutting back on the programs that deal with King's intellectual and moral legacy.
Well, Michael Eric Dyson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Terry.
Michael Eric Dyson is the author of I May Not Get There With You, The True Martin Luther King Jr. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.